greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on privacy when we come back. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, it was negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai. You and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits. Benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, George Bush said that what Americans wanted was jobs, jobs, jobs. But you know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognized that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It is not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. It's measured in property. There's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales. The money is in property. There's no money in public business, and there's no money in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's why I contend it's time you cashed in on your inheritance and learned how to collect those benefits from the Old Covenant contract. And to collect your benefits in property, like gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil, instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn more about how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on our CD Homeschool for Adults. That's our business school. And while you're at it, order our free general law CD package at the same time. You know, that's the place to start. It's free. Find out whether or not this is your cup of tea. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's informative, entertaining, educational, and free of charge. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. And if you're online, you can go to our website. The website is georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just call on the email, send us an email rather, and request that free general law CD package. Now again, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment is one of the Bill of Rights. Fifth Amendment is one of your Bill of Rights. You got three privacy amendments. First, fourth, and fifth. So a guy by the name of, let me get his name out here for you, Carl Warden, wrote a little treatise here concerning the Fifth Amendment, did a little research, and got some of the Fifth Amendment cases out and some Supreme Court, real neat, Supreme Court statements concerning your right to privacy under the Fifth Amendment. Most Americans believe that if a policeman asks them a question, they've got to answer it. I've tested it a few times just for the fun of it. There's actually some merit to just not saying anything at all. Now, as a driver, there is a need for you to say something, because when the policeman comes up to the window and he says, "I want your license, registration, and insurance," assuming that you've got a license, of course, you have to show it to him. The law requires that. That's what you agreed to when you secured that licensing privilege from the state. Then God himself tells us in Numbers chapter 30, you know, that what proceeds out of your mouth can't return again. If you've made an agreement, honor your agreement. Give him your license, registration, and insurance. But when the policeman asks you questions like, "Have you been drinking?" or "Why are you? Where are you going?" or "Where are you coming from?" you don't have to talk to him. You don't have to answer him. You don't have to say anything. The reason you talk to him is because you're trying to talk your way out of a ticket. So you start offering excuses. "Well, I'm late to church." Well, then you're appealing to his Christian charity, aren't you? Or, God, I'm late to work. Or, my wife is sick in the hospital and I'm hurrying to the hospital to visit her. Because then you're looking for sympathy. Now, this policeman is a revenue agent. If you're a policeman, you know you're a revenue agent. That's your job. Generate revenue. And you also know that if you don't generate revenue over there, your commander is going to be asking about that. You know, the average number of tickets that we write in this department is 2 a shift. And you're only writing 1.7 per shift, Bob. Now, what the hell's going on here? Tom over there is averaging 3 tickets per shift. Those are called quotas. And the police, they vehemently deny that they've got a quota system. Excuse me. Let's be intelligent people over here. Mr. Policeman, try writing no tickets whatsoever for 30 days and see what happens to your job, partner. For the next 30 days, every time you catch somebody speeding, give them a warning. Every time you catch somebody doing something, give them a ride home when they can't, when there's a problem. Instead of giving this guy a ticket for drunk driving, give him a ride home. Try that for 30 days and find out what happens to your job. Then tell me there's no quota, officer. Huh? I mean, that might play well, you know, somewhere else, but don't play here. Now, you know, every employee has a production schedule, a production goal. So, you know, as an employee, your boss expects a certain amount of production. And policemen aren't any different. Now, the truth of the matter is, if you're a detective on a police force over here and you've got a murder case that you're trying to solve, or in the case of the lacrosse team, a rape that you're trying to solve, you don't have any idea where this evidence is going to lead you. You don't know who did it. You don't know whether or not you can put the evidence together against this guy or not, or against anybody for that matter. And so, you know, police detectives, you know, oftentimes will work for years and years on a case. You know, once in a while you're watching one of these cop shows and or watching some 60-minute story, and this cop has been working for 15 years on this murder. It's a cold case now. And he finally gets the evidence together after all these years and brings this guy to justice. And now that's very laudable. That is something to be commended. And our expectations that the police are going to solve every single crime, every single time, is misplaced. It ain't going to happen. So jumping on the police because they haven't solved this or that crime over here is poppycock. Now, we presume that the police are working as hard as they can to find the guy that did it. And so the police are under this pressure, see. And we've got to find this guy because the press is on him, because there's civic leaders that are on him. Back off. Butt out. The big complaint that we all ought to have is the police being used as revenue generators. We all pay taxes. Taxes are what we use to support the police department, and we shouldn't be depending upon $5 million a year in fine to balance our city budget or our county budget. And if we'd stop doing that, we'd find that the police would be more helpful and less adversarial. But I don't make the rules and I don't make the policies, and so there's going to be an adversarial system. And that's not changing anytime soon. And the policeman is a part of an adversarial system. So he's not your friend. It's just that simple. He's an adversary. So, you know, in a business transaction, when I go into a business transaction with you, you're my adversary. You know, that's the way life is. When I come into your store, I'm the customer, you're my adversary. You're the salesman in the store, and I'm the customer, so I'm your adversary. You're trying to sell me these goods, and I'm trying to pay you as little as possible for it. So I tell you how bad the goods are, and you tell me how wonderful they are. I tell you how expensive and how unreasonable the price is, and you tell me how cheap it is, and what a great value that I'm getting. I mean, that's where reality is at. And so then maybe we make a deal or we don't make a deal, but I don't walk in there and say, well, gee, you're my friend Tom, you know. Here, let me sign the check and you fill in the amount, Tom. you know, when you're calling a contractor out to bid on a job in your kitchen, you know, you're going to remodel your kitchen over here, you get two or three contractors to come out there. Those contractors are your adversaries. Are they going to do you a job, a service? Are they going to be working in your house? Are you going to be working with these people, sir? I work with the police. They're adversaries. And I work with them because that's the name of the game, but it ought not to be that way. We shouldn't be adversaries. What's that got, you know, in mind? What's that all about? I pay your salary. I hire you. I support you. And then you want to give me a ticket? They got a program here in Springfield now. They put cameras up here at the intersections. I'll show you how the cops are out here for revenue. They're not out here to protect the public. Just revenue. They got these cameras up here at the busy intersections, you know, like Sunshine and Glenstone. And so you're driving up here at 35 miles an hour and the light turns yellow. And so your determination, do I slam on the brakes and throw the kid into the dashboard? Well, you're supposed to have him buckled in, right? Or do I step on the gas and speed through the intersection? So many times you'll say, oh, I'll just step on the gas and I'll speed through the intersection. And so at the exact second that the bumper of your car crosses the white pedestrian line, the light turns red. And the camera instantly takes a picture of your car, which is now in the intersection, running the red light. Very common practice. And so the public officials, they come and say, oh my God, they show us pictures of a traffic accident. And we've got these people running red lights. All right. People shouldn't run red lights. But that's not running a red light. And there's never been a traffic accident in America or anywhere in the world caused by somebody who's going through on the yellow light and it turned red. It's a physical impossibility because the traffic east-west has already stopped. Now they say, well, you're running a red light. Well, I guess technically you are. But it doesn't pose any threat to the health, safety, or welfare of anybody at any cause or time or any for any reason or any cause or reason or time. And the bottom line is it's a revenue generator. So I send you a ticket in the mail. Say I send a $75. And of course you'll send the $75 because they'll take your driver's license if they don't. And so it's just a tax is what it boils down to. And so to sit here and say that these people are out here protecting the health, safety, and welfare of the public is poppycock. Wake up and smell the coffee. Now, there are people that run red lights. I've seen that happen a time or two. I got to tell you a quick story here. I was driving down Chinden Boulevard one time, and then it was one of those kind of deals where, you know, if you drive 35 miles an hour, the lights will turn green. Every time you come to one, it'll turn green for you, see? And so that's pretty convenient. So I'm driving 35, and the lights are all turned. I get down to 42nd Street there at the Outlaw, And as I'm approaching, you know, about maybe a block away, my ankle itched. And so I reached down. I'd take my foot off the gas pedal so I could reach down and scratch my itch. See? So I'm scratching my itch. And my pickup is slowing down. See? So from 35, maybe it's slowing down to 20. I don't remember exactly. And so pretty soon I get the itch taken care of, and then I resume speed. Now, just before I get to the intersection, the light's green. Hell, this light's been green for a block or two. I'm concerned that maybe I'm going too slow and I'm going to miss this light. It's still green. But before I get to the intersection, here comes a 10-wheel dump truck racing through the intersection. Right in front of me. I slammed on the brake. Scared the hell out of me. Had I been, you know, another 100 feet ahead, I would have been in the intersection, and that truck more likely would have hit me. Now, I don't know if I hadn't had that itch, if I'd have been through the intersection on the other side, and he'd have raced in behind me. Or in this case, I was slowed down, so he raced across. That guy ran the red light. Boy, that was a threat. Had he hit me, might have killed me. And then we'd say, now, we need to do something about people that run red lights. What exactly are you going to do to prevent that guy from running the red light? Nothing. I wasn't anything I could do to prevent him from running the red light, and there isn't anything that you're going to do, isn't anything the police are going to do, and you can set 15 cameras up there, ain't going to do jack diddly squat. I don't know what the guy was thinking about, and it was a close call, and we're sorry that it happened, but that's the way life is. Now, if there had been a cop there, he should have ran after that guy, gave him a ticket, and said, hey, wake up, turkey, and smell the coffee here. And did it ever occur to anybody that maybe the light malfunctioned and it was showing green in both directions? I don't know. I couldn't see what the light color was in his traffic lane. He raced through the intersection. My presumption is that the light was red because mine was green. But, you know, things like that happen, don't they? And had he hit me and killed me, I'd be dead and pushing up daisies today. And maybe the guy would have gone to prison for manslaughter or something. I don't know. Was it an accident? Was the guy drunk? Was he off on drugs or something like that? I don't know. Now, protecting the health, safety, and welfare of the public is done pretty darn nicely by the traffic lights. You know, those traffic lights really work neat, don't they? And they regulate traffic. It's all automatic. You don't have to have a traffic cop there. You're not paying a salary. It's all automated. Works like a shot. God, I love them. Stop signs work pretty good, and if everybody is doing his job, and if the policeman is out here, you know, when you see somebody that just flagrantly runs the red light or flagrantly runs the stop sign, yeah, let's go out there and give it, especially the 17-year-old pimply-faced punk kids, huh? Let's give them a ticket and wake them up to reality. But the concept of turning traffic regulation into a tax base doesn't do anything for the health, safety, and welfare of the public. It's an adversarial system, and it turns us into adversaries. Now, let's understand that the police are your adversary. That's the bottom line. So if he's going to be your adversary, let's treat him like one. I mean, if the policeman wants to be the adversary, let's treat him like an adversary. And let's do business with him. Now, remember the Supreme Court said there can be no doubt that the Fifth Amendment privilege is available outside of criminal court. Outside of criminal proceedings, and serves to protect persons in all settings in which their freedom of action is curtailed in any significant way from being compelled to incriminate themselves. Even if you get a driver's license, a social security number, and you're a ward of the state, you've got certain basic rights guaranteed under the Constitution. Fifth Amendment rights are protected, and the Constitution is a higher law than the traffic laws of your state. Did you know that? There's a pecking order here. So you've got laws in your state, and these laws oftentimes contradict or work at loggerheads with your constitutionally protected rights. Now, you can't claim these constitutionally protected rights unless you know what they are. And don't expect the policeman to be protecting your rights. He's working against your rights. He's working for the state, remember? He's your adversary. He's not going to tell you. In fact, he might even lie to you about him and say, well, you don't have that right. It's privilege. It's up to you to know what your rights are. After all, you're a voter. After all, you're the sovereign. After all, you're the master, aren't you? Does the master go to his servant and ask him what the law is, for crying out loud? If the policeman is your servant, do you ask your servant? Or do you tell your servant what the law is? No, I'm an old-timey employer. I never brought an employee into my office and asked him jack diddly squat. I brought him in and I told him. So if the policeman is standing there telling you, well, then he's your master. And if that's the master-servant relationship that you want, then take your hat off and say, yes, sir. Now, please also note the above is stated by the Supreme Court are rights and privileges as guaranteed by the Constitution, and anyone, including judges, who knowingly violates those rights may be civilly and criminally liable under several federal statutes. It's a criminal act for a judge, a policeman, a public official to violate your constitutional rights. Did you know that? Well, now you know. You have certain rights, privileges, and immunities, and if those are abridged, the people that abridge them are trespassers. They're tortfeasors. Now, if more individuals were to understand their rights and exercise them at the appropriate times, we'd be a whole lot more successful in reining in the tyranny that you're all complaining about here in America. I'll tell you a little story over here up in Boise, Idaho. We used to have a police chief up there. His name was Jim Montgomery. And I had a conversation with him one day, and I told him, I said, I'm retired. And I got nothing to do but fight with you for the rest of my life. And if you got anything better to do, you better get after it. Now, we organized up there a citizens group called Barristers Inn. Barristers Inn, and we had probably, I don't know, 100 citizens, probably as members. And our job was to keep the police in check. Now, Montgomery told me that 168 policemen in Boise at that time. And it was very common for the police to do the Rodney King trip. See, all these policemen in Boise, Idaho are Mormons. And, you know, Mormons are good people, but, you know, they got their ways. And they don't drink, and they don't like people that do. So when they catch somebody out here on the streets drinking, they jerk him out of his car, kick him in the ribs three times, tighten the cuffs up. I mean, they administered curbstone court right there on the street, just like Rodney King. And we took a look at that and said, you know, policemen are hired here to perform a service, perform a job. And we'll let we want the judicial system, we want the judges to administer the punishment, and not the police. And so we started photographing, just like Rodney King, back before Rodney King. And I told Montgomery that. I said, you know, we got a video camera out here on the street in a van. And we're recording, and we've got tape recordings. We started tape recording the police stops. And then the police would take the tape recorder, take your tape out of it, and destroy the evidence. So then we started mounting the tape recorders under the dashboard and concealing the microphones. And we would get the police, you know, making these kinds of criminal stops, no probable cause. Or the policeman would be rude, arrogant, and obnoxious. And we got the photographs of it. It didn't take very long. You know, when you get videotape of policemen violating people's rights, when you get voice recordings of the actual conversation of the police with the in the traffic stop and so on, it doesn't take very long in a couple of three civil rights actions well placed in your local community. And here's the way that Judge Callison explained it to me. I was up in the courthouse one day, and Callison, who was the chief judge at the time, he is a federal judge. He said, you know, Gordon, nobody gives a rat's you know what as to what your rights are. But there is one group that are very concerned about it. One guy. It's the claims manager of the insurance company. And he said, when you sue public officials, the insurance company has to come out and defend. And he said, when the insurance company has to defend, they send the claims manager up to the mayor, or the city council members, or the chief of police, or the building inspector, whoever the offender is, and they tell them, you know, we got to come in here and defend you, and you need to change your policy here. Well, in Boise, Idaho, the policy was changed there under Chief Montgomery pretty dramatically, because I had a student by the name of Rick Mitchell, and Rick Mitchell was in the Ada County Jail for 5 months. And I paid his rent. I paid his expenses. I paid his utilities. I paid him to stay in jail for 5 months on a contempt charge from Barristers Inn. And in 5 months, we were unable to get a single violation against the Ada County Jail in 5 months with a paid professional undercover agent in the jail. That was a turnaround. I mean, you could go into that jail. Those jailers in there couldn't help but violate your rights. They didn't know any better. But after about three or four well-placed civil rights lawsuits, the claims manager got in there and started talking to them. Let me give you an illustration as to how the numbers work. Boise, Idaho is in Ada County. It's a small county, but it's the county seat. It's the seat of the state government. And Boise is also the county seat. Well, listen, they got this big, humongous jail out here. And they called it the Ada County Law Enforcement Center, I believe it was. And I mean, they got county and city policemen running around here, and they didn't know what their duties were. They didn't know which end was up. And they were violating rights from one after another. I mean, they were beating people up in there. Well, finally, one day, they screwed up like they were prone to do, and they killed a kid in the jail. And this kid is underage. He wasn't supposed to be in there. He's a juvenile. And so they paid out about a $3 million settlement on this wrongful death. And Ada County at that time was paying about, if I remember the number right, it was around $3 million a year in liability premium for their liability policy. Well, when that case came down, they canceled their insurance. The insurance company that was carrying them canceled it. And then the next company that came in doubled the premium to $7 million a year. So along comes barristers in, and we started filing some lawsuits. Now, I'm not claiming that we get all the credit. I'm just saying that we started throwing gasoline on the fire. Now, once the fire got going, we started throwing gas on. And the second company that took them on for $7 million a year canceled their insurance policy after 1 year. And they had to go back out in the marketplace, and the next company came in at $14 million. Now, take a look at what happened here. Their insurance premiums went from $3 to $14 million in 24 months. And their civil rights violations went from, you can't count them all, to zero in the same 24 months. And now, that's what well-placed civil rights actions do to the local public policy. So if you want to bring your police back into compliance with the Constitution, you do it through the Civil Rights Act. Now, for more serious matters, if you are contacted as a possible suspect or even a witness in any other law enforcement investigation, you are to say nothing. You are to say nothing even when your attorney is present. You are to say nothing regardless of evidence of your guilt as presented by the law enforcement officers. You are not to try to explain away the circumstances of the evidence that they present to you. You are to say absolutely nothing. No matter how tempted you may be to try to talk your way out of the situation, you are to give your adversary absolutely nothing, nothing to verify. If they ask you if the sky is blue on a clear day, you say nothing. You are to give them nothing whatsoever. Whatever evidence or witness information they have, you are to say nothing about it. Even denying any of their allegations can be used against you in a prosecution. If it's determined later that you obviously lied, you are to stay mute. I told you that in the last program or the one before. I said, look, Martha Stewart's crime was in lying. It wasn't the stock transaction. It was in lying. Had she exercised her Fifth Amendment right and remained silent, she never would have been prosecuted or convicted. She didn't have any need to tell the cops anything. They were adversaries. And she talked. And when she talked, she lied. And when she lied, she was prosecuted. And when she was prosecuted, she was convicted. Had she said nothing, kept her mouth shut, never would have happened. There's a classic case. Now, the reason for this is very simple. The evidence that the law enforcement officers have is all they must be required to work with. Don't give them anything more. The only time you should consider the option of telling your side of the story is to your attorney in privacy, or in court, if you're being prosecuted. Remember, the police are seeking evidence to be used against you. And they tell you that very plainly. I mean, you got to be stupid to sit here and talk to a guy that says to you very plainly, looks you right in the eyeball and says, you have a right to remain silent, and anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. Now, let's get down to where were you going? Where were you coming from, and what's your name, address, and telephone number, and social security number, and are you married, and how many children do you have, and where do you work, and how much money do you make? You've got to be nuts to answer any questions for a guy that plainly tells you anything you say to me can and will be used against you in a court of law. Then Americans go right in there and try to talk their way out of it. All you're going to do, partner, is dig a hole that you'll never get out of. Now, because you've stayed mute, giving law enforcement nothing in addition to the extrinsic evidence and witness information at hand, the burden of proof available to the district attorney is severely limited and will most often result in a dismissal of charges unless their evidence and witness input is overwhelming and compelling enough for a grand jury to return a bill of indictment. And even if you're bound over for trial, the jury will be limited to consider only what evidence the witness input has for the prosecution. Now, when you're given your Miranda rights, wherein you are informed that anything you say can and will be used against you, take it to heart. If you say absolutely nothing, 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 keep your mouth shut. Nothing can and will be used against you in a court of law. If you say nothing, nothing will be used against you. If you say something, something will be used against you. If you say a lot will be used against you. The more you talk, the more they have to use against you. Now, there are literally thousands of people behind bars today who tried to talk their way out of the law enforcement contact. So don't fall for the ploy. Law enforcement officers are trained to bluff you into making denials, into making statements, and they will appear friendly, and they appear reasonable, and they will appear willing to help resolve the matter. They will pose as your friend, and they will tempt you to talk about it and to appear sympathetic. Don't fall for it. Say nothing. Give them nothing. Deny everything. Deny nothing. Give them nothing. Stick your tongue between your teeth and bite down hard. You are to be a marble statue. You do not exist. You have no past. You have no address. You have no name. You have no social security number. You are to give them nothing whatsoever to work with. Now, that's the advice of an attorney. I'm not an attorney, at least not an attorney hired by the public. I'm not for sale, and so I don't give legal advice. I just report what others say. This is what our Supreme Court tells us. This is what our law books and our law schools and our law teachers tell us. We don't practice it. That's what our problem is. We don't practice it. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement only. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, go to our homeschooling page on our website, and I'll tell you the scoop. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed to the website as well. Remember, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet daily. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. Now, the Law School offers you a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we use here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station, but they should. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Talking about privacy here. If you'd like a copy of this article, it was published on 8/11/2003 by the Federal Observer. It's www.federalobserver.com. archive.php AID equal 2578. So I imagine it's document 2578 from their archives. That's the federalobserver.com. I thought that was a pretty good article. I teach that to my students. Now let's shift gears here a little bit and show you another little piece of privacy over here that maybe you hadn't considered. It has to do with do you speak credit. Oftentimes, you will sign a consumer credit contract. And that contract has some little secret words in it. I use the term little secret words. They're a little underhanded, sneaky, misunderstood terms in the contract, which are designed to deceive you. And as a result of that, you'll oftentimes sign a contract and waive your rights. And the question comes up in law quite often, can you waive your rights? And the answer is yes. Does contract supersede your rights? And the answer is yes, it does. So when you sign a contract, you can sign your rights away. And of course, your opponent here, you know, the guy that's trying to sell you this car, the guy that's selling you this big screen TV, he wants you to sign this consumer contract. The banks do this. They're notorious. You know, your Constitution guarantees you a right to a jury trial in all matters in excess of $20. Now, our founding fathers didn't put this constitutional provision into our Constitution for no good reason. They felt that a jury trial, a jury over here, would be a better source, you know, people just like you out here in the society, would be a better source of justice. It's not expedient. It's not fast. It's time-consuming. It's cumbersome. It's inefficient. But it's the best way that we've ever devised for coming up with justice, and it comes from the Mosaic Law. It was Moses that gave us this concept of going to the congregation to resolve a matter of fact. So the banks come along and they say, well, this is cumbersome, it's expensive, and besides that, oftentimes we lose when the bank goes against a consumer who has a complaint about the bank gouging them. And so the bank, when they issue the credit card, they have a consumer contract. And in the contract, which none of you people ever read, primarily you don't read it because you can't see it. The print is so small, you need a 10-power loop. So I would advise you to go into your local coin store and get a 10-power loop so that you can read the contract. I got a big magnifying glass here. I don't know where I got it, but I mean, it's got a lens on it that's about... Oh, hell, it's 4 inches. Let me get my tape out here and I'll measure this. I got this magnifying glass. It fits right over the page. And I can just pull it right across the page and I can read it in great big letters. And I don't wear glasses. But I can't read this stuff. This thing is 4 1/4 inches in diameter. It's 3 3/4 on the top and 4 1/4 on the bottom. And then I've got another one over here. Here's another loop. You can get this in a coin store also. It goes right over your head. And it's got a 10-power magnifier right here. You look right through both eyeballs. And I get this to evaluate coins and to look at fine, you know, marks on coins. and also use it for reading contracts. And you need it to read a contract because these contracts are written in fine print so that you cannot understand. You cannot read it, first of all. And if you could read it, unless you've got a degree from college, you probably couldn't understand it anyway. And oftentimes, I need a dictionary to read a contract. I mean, I teach this law, and I got to have a damn dictionary here to read the contracts that these people put in front of me. And so if I need a magnifying glass and I need a dictionary to read this contract over here, I can just about imagine what the average housewife and truck driver are going through. You just don't waste the time on it. As a result of that, you waive your rights. They write into the contractor rights waivers so that you're waiving your constitutional right to a jury trial, for instance. Let me read to you a contract term here. It says, for a value received, the undersigned jointly and severally hereby assign, transfer, convey, and set over unto the assignee named above 10% of all salary, wages, commissions, and other compensation for services severally earned or to be earned severally by us in the employ of the employer specified under our names set forth below, by whom we are severally now employed, or any future employer until the loan secured hereby and described below shall have been fully discharged. We severally hereby authorized and directed our employer or any future employers or either of them to pay said part of salary, wages, commission, or other compensation for services to the said assignee and release such employers or any future employers from all liability to us on account of any and all monies paid in accordance with the terms hereof. We severally give and grant unto the said assignee full power and authority to demand, receive, and receipt for the same or any part thereof in any of our names. All right, now that's the contract provision. Did you understand that? Now, I understand that because I have read that provision. This is what we call a standard clause in a consumer contract. Nearly all consumer contracts have that clause in it. So if you're sitting there glazed over and you say to yourself, I didn't understand a word of that, welcome to the club. You weren't supposed to understand it, partner, because if you understood it, you'd have to be brain dead to sign that document. And I'll bet you that you got lots of documents signed that have that clause in it. Here's what that clause means in plain English. This is truck driver lingo. What that means is if I don't pay, just have my boss deduct the money from my paycheck. I will not argue about it, even if I have a good reason for not paying. Here's what that means. If I don't pay, just have my boss deduct the money from my paycheck. I won't argue about it, and even if I have a good reason for not paying. Now, that's what you're signing up to, and in this clause, there are six separate rights that are waived in the terms and conditions of that clause. And that's just one of many clauses that will be in this contract. Rights that were built into your Constitution, you're waiving by signing the agreement. And so we hereby assign, transfer, convey, and set over unto the assignee, that's the creditor, 10% of our salary, wages, and commissions. All right. Now, the good part of it is that they're only going to take 10%. So whatever your gross pay is, let's suppose you're getting $2,000 a month, then you agree to set over 10%, $200 a month. Furthermore, you agree to have your property taken from you. We can't take your property from you without your consent. We're going to get your consent when we sign you up in the purchase. Now, let's suppose that this product that you buy goes haywire. And you say, here, fix this product. And the seller says, we're not going to fix it. Too bad for you. And so you say, well, then I'm going to quit making payments on it if you don't fix it. Because the warranty says that it's guaranteed for a year. 8 months into the contract, the thing goes haywire. You've got a legitimate complaint. But you know what, partner?
All he has to do is exercise the contract and have your boss deduct the $200 a month, and there's nothing you can do about it. You say, well, I'll go get a lawyer. Well, good luck. The lawyer can't do anything about that. You've already signed it away. It's gone. And you say, well, that's not just. Well, of course it isn't just. It's adversarial. We have an adversary system. Now, that's one of the reasons that I don't have a credit card. I got an ad in here the other day. It came from, I think it was American Express. And they told me all the neat things about the American Express card and, you know, all the benefits of it. And I said, well, let me get my 10-power loop out here and let me read the fine print. So I got to reading the fine print. Now, in the event that there's a controversy over the terms and conditions of the contract, I waive my right to a jury trial, and I agree that I will accept binding arbitration. Guess who gets to pick the arbitrator? American Express. Now, here's what American Express does. American Express, like Bank of America or Citicorp, is a big multinational corporation. They've got more money than they can shake a stick at. And they go out and they create little companies. And one of the companies that they create is the Acme Arbitration Service. So the American Express Corporation then signs a contract with the Acme Arbitration Service, wholly owned, bought and paid for by the American Express Corporation. Then they come to you and they say, would you like to have our credit card? And you say, yes, I'd like to have your credit card. I don't have a 10-power loop. I don't have a degree from college. And I don't know how to read contracts. I'm just an average Joe Sixpack. And so you sign up. You're working along here, and the American Express company screws you for whatever reason. And you say to yourself, well, that's not right. And I want to sue them. So you go into court and you file suit. You couldn't get a lawyer to do it because he can read the contract. And so your lawyer now says, well, you can't sue them because you have agreed to binding arbitration. So lawsuits are out. And so you say, well, okay, well, who's going to be the arbitrator? And your lawyer informs you, well, it's going to be the Acme Arbitration Company. Now, of course, nobody's going to tell you that the Acme Arbitration Company is a wholly owned subsidiary of the American Express Corporation, but when you get into it and you start looking, that's what you're going to find. Now, what kind of a decision do you think you're going to get out of Acme Arbitration? You know, it's like going to the Gordon Court of Justice. I operate my own Gordon Court of Justice here. My wife is the judge, my son is the prosecutor, my daughter is the public defender, and I'm the complaining party. So I bring an action against you in the Gordon Court of Justice. We try you in front of my wife, prosecute you with my son, defend you with my daughter, and we call that a fair trial. What do you think of that? Hell, you do it in your state. The state brings an action against you. The state pays the judge. The state pays the prosecutor. The state pays the policeman who's the witness against you. The state makes the rules. The state then offers you a public defender licensed by the state, and you call that a fair trial, don't you? I'm not sure that Americans are able to think anymore. I think we've been indoctrinated to the point that today education is a word that we use, but it doesn't have any meaning. Indoctrination, I think, is the better term. Here's another real neat one. It says, the undersigned jointly and severally waive any right of privacy of any nature in connection with this instrument. Hey, we're talking about privacy, and here's a standard clause in your contract that says the undersigned jointly and severally waive any right of privacy of any nature in connection with this instrument, regardless of whether or not the debt evidenced hereby may be contested, and agree that the lender may at its option communicate with any persons whatsoever in relation to the obligation involved, or its delinquency, or in an effort to obtain cooperation or help relative to the collection or payment thereof. Okay, now here's what that means in plain language. If I don't pay, you can tell all my friends and relatives and my boss that I'm a deadbeat. Isn't that just special? Thought you'd like that. again, if I don't pay, you can tell all of my friends and relatives and my boss that I'm a deadbeat. That's not libel. That's not slander. I agree to it. I mean, that's like me coming to you and saying, hey, listen, I want you to sign this agreement with me so that I can say anything I want about you with no repercussions. I can call you names. I can call you a thief. I can call you a liar. And you can't do anything about it. Would you sign that with me? Well, why would you sign that with Best Buy? Why would you sign that with Target or Beneficial Finance or with Ford Motor Finance or with General Motors Acceptance? Why would you give anybody, a credit card company or anybody else, that kind of power over you? Here's another neat one. It says the creditor may retain the goods in his property or as his property, or may sell or otherwise dispose of the item pursuant to the Uniform Commercial Code, whereupon the debtor shall be liable for and shall pay any deficiency on demand. In plain language, that means if you repossess what I bought from you and you don't get a good resale price for it, I'll still owe you the difference. For example, if you take back a perfectly good $500 TV and you only sell it for $150, I lose the TV and I still owe you $350. And you agreed to that. I mean, you signed on the bottom line. Now, privacy is something that you work at all the time. And it's something that you have to be aware of, cognizant of all the time. That means you've got to be able to read and write. And you've got to be illiterate. So if you've been to the public school system, you may not be literate. You know, the old adage, you know, Johnny can't read, is probably... You got some merit to it. Government schools turn out about 2 million American graduates every year that can't read their diploma. Did you know that? 2 million a year. Latest numbers I saw. And these are people with a diploma that says, I've graduated from high school. And the guy can't read his diploma? So maybe the first thing we got to do is teach how to read. Now, there's another clause over here I'll share with you. This note is secured by a security interest in all of the following described personal property and proceeds thereof. If checked, it left consumer goods, furniture, appliances, bric-a-brac, now owned and hereafter acquired, including replacements and located in or about the premises of the debtor's residence, unless otherwise stated, or at any other location to which the goods may be moved. In addition, all other goods and chattels of like nature hereafter acquired by the debtor and kept or used in or about said premises and substituted for any property mentioned. Proceeds and products of the collateral are also covered. What that means in plain language is if I don't pay, you can take all the household goods that I own. Now, that's called a standard clause in a contract. And people agree to those all the time. It's a privacy issue that ought to be outside the scope of anything else you buy. Try it this way. Go down to Best Buy, you buy a big screen TV, you're on the hook for $2,000. You're going to pay this thing at $50 a month for the next 2 or 3 years. And so they have you sign this consumer contract that contains this common clause called a standard clause in a consumer contract. You don't make the payment on the TV for whatever reason. It blew up and they won't honor the warranty. They can come in and take all of your household goods and sell them on the courthouse steps. This is a very common practice by the IRS. Let me tell you a little tale here. The IRS puts a lien on your property. You're an old man. They put a lien on your property. Now, the property is worth $100,000, but they put the thing up for sale, and when it's auctioned off, the IRS comes in and they bid $10,000 on it and buy it at a private sale that nobody else even knows about. Now your property has been sold at public auction that nobody else knew about. You couldn't come in and bid, and they take your property for $10,000. Well, let's try the consumer outfit. So you don't pay, and you got this clause. You got $10,000 worth of furniture in your house. They come in, take your furniture by distraint. You know, the sheriff is standing out here with six deputies as Beacons comes over here, loads up all your stuff, hauls it out. They put it up for sale. What does used furniture sell for? 10 cents on the dollar. So you got $10,000 worth of furniture and stuff, it sells for $1,000. You owe $2,000 on the big screen TV. They took $10,000 worth of furniture, sold it for $1,000. You paid $500 on the TV. They took the TV back, they sold it for $150, and you still got a $350 deficiency on the TV. And they wiped you out. But you agreed to it. You agreed to it. It's because you waived your privacy to your property in your house. And you signed it when you signed the consumer contract. So I said, you know, anybody that could read one of these and sign it would have to be brain dead. You'd have to be, you know, you need a guardian to sign one of these. That's like I said, that's once I learned how to read, you know, I stopped signing these contracts. That's why I don't have any credit cards. If you could read the contract, you wouldn't have a credit card either. People that can read don't have credit cards. Because of the power that it gives to the bank or to any other agency, any other seller that you're contracting with. There's just nothing like paying cash and walking out with the goods that you own. So what you need to do is to wait until you can afford to buy what it is that you want. The big screen TV is $2,000. I got one the other day. I got to tell a story here. I've coveted and lusted after a big screen plasma TV for years, and I've priced them at $2,700, and then they went down a little bit to $2,300, then they went down to about $2,000. Now they're selling for about $1,900 here. So the other day, went in and bought one out of a pawn shop used for $800. Now I paid cash for it and own it. Now, nobody's going to take my furniture. Nobody's going to is going to ding me now because I don't pay them, because I lose my job or something. Now, I had to wait a while to do that, and then I had to do without. I didn't do without TV. I had my old TV sitting up there on the aquarium right now. It's been sitting there for years and years, and I didn't sign any contracts to waive any of my rights at any time for any cause or reason. You ever sign a co-signer contract? You know, if I don't pay, you can collect from my co-signer without trying to collect from me first. And we'll talk about that next time here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. As we're talking about privacy and how we waive our rights to privacy by signing our names or by opening our mouths or by failing to shut up. All right, we'll take a look at that next time. Let me give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to get one. Just call us and ask for it. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to our website and click onto the email. Send us an email request. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Okay, our time's up. We're going to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.